This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. And it is exactly midnight on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. So please do stay tuned for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. right. Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade here on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, where we are opening up with some sounds of the group Zikrayat, a pan-Arab ensemble based here in New York City, who, listeners will recall, we actually featured live in the studio last year, and this is from their album Live at Lotus. I'm not quite sure where Lotus is. Anybody know where Lotus is? Probably people who get out more than I do know where Lotus is. But a lot of their songs are interpretations of themes from the golden age of Arab cinema in the 1950s, mostly Egyptian cinema, and I believe that one was, the name of that song was Yama, a love song. I'm not quite sure what Yama stands for or it means, but it was from the film, let's see, light is not too good in here. Can't quite read the name of the film. Well, maybe some Egyptian film buff can call us in and tell us some of the more of the details. But actually, we do have a phone call, phone interview that we're going to try to get to this evening. People are probably aware that there were provincial elections which were held in Iraq on Saturday. And, you know, it's very interesting the way it's being played in the press is that, oh, this is such a, you know, a great stride for democracy and stability in Iraq. And, you know, now there's almost this sense of mission accomplished, right? Even as that catchphrase became such a cruel joke, thanks to its premature use, shall we say, by the former commander-in-chief. Now there really is sort of a sense, although nobody's actually invoking the phrase because that would just be a little bit too much of a faux pas. But there really is this sort of a sense of, oh, well, you know, Iraq is back from the brink and it's, in good hands and things are just going swimmingly there. And we can, move along now to Afghanistan, which is now heating up again and starting to look like Iraq was a couple of years ago. So, you know, isn't it funny when things were going really badly in Iraq, we sort of felt like Afghanistan had been relegated to the sideshow status, and nobody was paying any attention to what was going on there, even though it continued to be pretty bad. And now it looks like it's, you know, the opposite, because if you look pretty closely at what's been going on in Iraq, well, one of the things which they've been touting is the fact that 4,000 women ran for the provincial council seats in the elections on Saturday. And there was actually, although the media accounts have been very sketchy on this, and it was subject to a great deal of controversy, there was some kind of a quota system to assure a certain number of seats for women on the provincial councils. But at the meantime, there have been, even though this has been sort of touted by the media as a symbol of Iraq's progress, there have been some serious setbacks for women in Iraq, including a pending provision in the regional constitution for Iraqi Kurdistan, which would instate polygamy. And this is really a bit of an irony, because Iraqi Kurdistan was always, relatively speaking, something of a liberated zone within Iraq, since it was able to establish its own autonomy after Desert Storm. And it wasn't under the heel of Saddam, although Saddam was a secularist tyrant, and actually women had a better deal under Saddam than they have had subsequently in many ways. And then in the, you know, rise of political Islamist, fundamentalist political parties and militias, which have been ruling Iraq and tearing Iraq apart since the fall of Saddam, well, likewise, they never quite established a strong foothold in Kurdistan in the north, because that was under the control of the Kurdish nationalist parties, who were somewhat authoritarian but secular.
women certainly had a much better deal. And generally, the, you know, sectarian violence did not reach into Kurdistan to a significant degree. But there's even, as we see, signs of backsliding there. So it's quite an ironic situation. And we're going to be joined in just a few minutes by our good friend Kayal Ibrahim of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, ALFI, who has been waging a campaign, particularly against the polygamy provision, which is about to be instated, it seems, in the regional constitution of the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq. She is in Toronto, and we'll be putting through a call to her after we take another brief musical break shortly. The one thing I want to do before we get to that is read a couple of announcements. There's going to be two events which are going to be happening over the course of the next 10 days or so, which you should be aware of. Mark your calendars now. One of them is that there's going to be a protest against the notorious Lev Lavayev, who is a diamond merchant, Israeli diamond merchant, and the richest man in Israel, and a major funder of illegal settlement building in the occupied West Bank. As many of our listeners will be aware, because we've done some programming about the charming Mr. Lavayev and his activities, and the group Adala New York, a Palestinian group which is acting around, particularly around campaigns of what they call BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is going to be holding a Valentine's protest in front of Lavayev's NYC offices, not on Valentine's Day, but a week before Valentine's Day, this coming Saturday, February 7th at 1 p.m. at 700 Madison Avenue. That's between 62nd and 63rd. Adala, New York, will be holding Lev Lavayev accountable for building Israeli settlements by telling all those shopping for gifts for their sweethearts that Lev's diamonds are a crime's best friend. Ha 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 ha. The campaign to boycott Lavayev is part of a growing movement for BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Against Israel. BDS has been given added impetus by Israel's war crimes in Gaza. So please do join Adala New York at the protest against Lev Lavayev. Very opportune time to make this point. At their Valentine's protest in front of Lavayev's offices here in New York City. Once again, that's going to be this Saturday, February 7th at 1 p.m. at 700 Madison Avenue between 62nd and 63rd Streets. And if you want more information, you can go to adalany.org. That's A-D-A-A-L-A-H. I'm sorry, just A-D-A-L-A-H-N-Y, Adalany, A-D-A-L-A-H-N-Y, Adalany.org. And you can get all the information you need there. But one more time, it's going to be this Saturday, 1 p.m. at 700 Madison Avenue. And, well, let's see. The Libertarian Book Club's Anarchist Forums, I'm trying to get used to the new time. They're now at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it seems, on Saturdays, after years and years and years of being at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. But the last one that we had just this past Saturday with Osha Newman talking about his new book on the history of the 1960s Lower East Side anarchist group, the Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers, so to speak, was very, very good. Very, very, very interesting discussion. And he not only had to say, he not only talked about the history of the Mother Freakers, but also sort of applying the lessons of that experience to the contemporary crisis of world capitalism. And there's going to be another such opportunity. This one's actually being on Valentine's Day. So if you're looking for a hot date for Valentine's Day, Saturday, February 14th, please hear Jordan Zinovich And friends speaking on the Provos, Amsterdam's anarchist revolt of the 1960s. The Provos were an historic 1960s anarchist group that combined humor and provocation of the police to elicit violent responses by nonviolent bait. Please oppress us. It kind of sounds like a Monty Python routine, doesn't it? Help, help, I'm being repressed. But the Provos were sort of similar in spirit to the up-against-the-wall mother freakers of the Lower East Side, except that they were in Old Amsterdam instead of New Amsterdam. And it doesn't actually say so in this blurb, but I'm aware that one initiative of the Provos was the so-called White Bicycle Campaign, where they actually had these bicycles which were painted white, which people could just pick up and ride wherever they wanted and then just leave them. Somebody else would come along and pick them up, and it was kind of like community transportation. And this is actually being adopted as, and now, you know, how many years after the fact? 30 years or more, going on 40 years after the fact. That's actually being adopted as an official policy by some European cities. I'm not quite sure if it could work in New York. Maybe. But in any event, this will be another opportunity to talk about the experience of 60s ultra-leftism and what it means for the contemporary world capitalist crisis. So please do join Jordan Zinovich, Lindsay Kaplan, Jana Schoenberg, and others speaking about Provo, Amsterdam's anarchist revolt. It's going to be happening once again, and there will also be archival film footage of the Provos in Amsterdam back in the late 1960s. Once again, it's going to be happening this Saturday, not this Saturday, but a week from this Saturday, February 14th, so I'll have the opportunity to announce it again next week at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. Where, you might ask? Well, I'll tell you. It's going to be at the Living Theater. The Living Theater is at 21 Clinton Street, which is south of Houston, about a block, around half a block south of Houston if you're coming from the north, or a block and a half north of Delancey if you're coming from the south. Clinton Street is basically the continuation of Avenue B. After Avenue B hits Houston Street, it turns into Clinton Street. So that's where it is, 21 Clinton Street. Not this Saturday, but a week from this Saturday, February 14th, 2 p.m., and if you want more information, you can call the Libertarian Book Club at 212-979-8353. One more time. That's 212-979-8353. Or just go to the website of this radio show, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade website, which is morc.info, and click on the links page and click on the link for Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum, and all the information will be right there at your fingertips for those of you who are jacked. So there you go. There's your activist calendar for the next 10 days. And now why don't we hear a little bit more of Zikrayat, while we put through our phone call to Kayal Ibrahim up in the Great White North of Canada to speak about the situation in her homeland of Iraqi Kurdistan and what the much-touted new elections really mean for Iraq, secularism, and particularly for women in Iraq. And what the pending new constitution in Iraqi Kurdistan really means for these things. So please do stay tuned. We'll be back at you after another brief musical interlude, and hopefully we'll have Kayal on the line by then. Okay, why don't we hear cut four.
Oh.
Hello, Kyle.
Yes.
You're there.
Yes, I am.
Welcome aboard to listener-supported non-commercial WBAI in New York City.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good to hear from you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
So you're up in Toronto, if I got that right?
Yes.
Is it cold?
It's freezing.
I'll bet it is.
It is freezing cold.
Uh-huh. So, well, Iraq has actually been in the news in a favorable light recently. I don't know if you've been following the New York Times, but there was a big story about the 4,000 women who ran in the provincial election campaigns on Saturday.
I'm not sure about that, to be honest. I don't know about that 4,000. I did not read that magazine, but I'm in general, I'm aware of women's issues back home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there was some kind of a quota which was instated, making sure that women would have a certain number of seats on the provincial councils.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is 25% of seats. But to be honest, this type of that type of government, it means nothing for women's rights. No matter how many seats, if they have even more than 50% of, it does not mean that women are women's rights are equal in that country. That's because the parliament of Kurdistan in Iraq has just passed the civil law of Kurdistan, and that civil law is a very reactionary, and it's based and established on the slavery of women, and it's stressing the gender discrimination against women. So if there is a percentage of 25 or even 70%, if the whole law is based on discrimination against women, it means nothing to women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of question as to whether apparently there was some ambiguity in the wording of the election law, and it was seemed uncertain right up to the very last moment as to whether the quota was even going to be enforced.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and the media accounts which I've read seem to indicate that it was. Is that your understanding as well?
What I understand is it was the votes were 34 against that civil law and 39 with that. That's why it's almost passed. I'm not sure they are starting with that law, but I believe it did start already, but the whole thing is there was two there was two suggestions for law. One of them is based completely in civil law, and that women are men are equal in that law. And for example, there is no multiple marriage polygamy in that marriage, and that was rejected by these forces in the government. So,
okay, now we're talking about the national law or the Kurdistan regional
law? No,
the
Kurdistan in Iraq, civil law in Kurdistan. That's why our international campaign against that civil law of Kurdistan that passed recently, the last few months. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that new law encourages men to marry more than one woman, and it imposes a male guardian on women, and it's it's a practice of trading for women for money at marriage, and it maintains the inferiority for women in cases of of inheritance, in addition of all kind of discriminations, rules of Islamic Sharia law. So it's basically it's based on Sharia law.
Okay, now this is actually a provision of the regional constitution for Kurdistan.
Yes, that is the law was, there was just like I said, there was two loss, but there is a lot of people. There is two, what do you call it? There was two
proposals.
One of them was based like on civil law that it just completely prohibit multiple marriage for men. And there was this one. They decided to go with that, despite a lot of people were against it, even including the parliament members by themselves. There was, in the society, I remember like 20 years ago, there was people, they hated the person who married two women. Now they are bringing that in 2009, it's like, it's embarrassing for the women's movement in this world. So it's completely reactionary, and maybe some people will go by because that's based on Islamic traditions and reactionary movements and culture, but that doesn't mean that is the right thing. So the abuse of women is abuse if based on tradition or even religious, it's an abuse, and it has to be like all the people like in the world, all the humanitarian, they're supposed to fight it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say this was passed by the regional parliament of Kurdistan.
Yes, it was passed, and there was a lot of fight, and still there is a fight. But it's 100%. I'm not sure. Like about a week ago, I've heard that it's almost passed. But to be honest, I did not get the confirmation yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a vote which was taken back in October to put it into the draft constitution for Kurdistan, if I understand correctly.
Yes, that's right. And there was back and forth, and all these movements all over the world, and in Kurdistan there was a very big opposition for that. But I'm not sure exactly if they passed it or not, but that was the decision to pass on that. Law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have our campaign against the civil law of Kurdistan in Iraq, and we have to let the whole world know that the past 17 years, and if we go track the record of these forces clearly, it shows thousands of violations against women's rights, and it's promoting of religious and tribal practices and reactionary, issues about women.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, when you say that we are trying to have a campaign against it, the we is ALFI, Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq?
No, we are Women's Liberation of Iraq. And there is that's also ALFI is working, but I mean that is our campaign, is Women's Liberation of Iraq, of a group of women in Iraq, and we have some members in Canada, and we have some members in Europe, and we get a lot of support. We have a lot of demands for that, for immediate abolition of that civil law, that one of them, and the other one is to firm opposition and struggle against all forms of slavery and sexual discrimination against women. And the other point we have, our demands is prohibiting of any kind of interference of Islamic Sharia or any religious law in the family or public life. Our also demand is a complete separation of religious from state, and presenting alternative. Our alternative in this point is a secular and civil law, which is based on the principle of full equality between women and men.
Mm-hmm. So does Women's Liberation of Iraq, your new group, does it have much of a presence on the ground in Iraq?
We are like a few years, like new organization of a new, few years. We do have forces, but it's, to be honest, we are not too many. That's the whole thing. We are trying to work on that. There's like about 20 men and women working with us in only Baghdad. And in all over the world, we try to make it, to make the whole world hear us and listen to our demands and what we need to establish for women in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so where does this measure actually stand now? Because, I mean, I heard that the regional parliament of Kurdistan voted it up in October as a part of the draft constitution for Kurdistan. So it hasn't actually become official yet, is my understanding. Is that correct?
I've heard that last week. Like I said, last week I've heard that it almost became it became official. That's why I'm not 100% sure. Because if it was, we would for sure know. It's just I've heard like from a personal, like, you know, from, like, I mean, from a community that it's been passed. I mean, it's been official, which is that's why we find out. But there is a lot of opposition against us. So there is, you know, and I also heard that they may, it depends on how much opposition and how much the struggle against it. If it's like a fight, it's between them and the movement of women's rights. So, and of course they have powers that reactionary powers or whatever you call it. But they have military, they have drills, they fight women's rights and they know how to fight it. So it's a huge responsibility, and we know it's not that easy, but we have to work on it. Mm. So even if it's passed, it doesn't mean that's the end of it. We have to say, okay, it's been passed and that's it. No, we still have to fight it.
Okay, so but you're still awaiting word as to whether in fact it now is officially a part of the regional constitution of Kurdistan.
Personally, I haven't heard that it is official. I just heard personal, but not as officially. I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, it's a bit of an irony, actually, because Kurdistan has sort of been an island of comparative freedom, secularism, and stability in Iraq, as the rest of the country has sort of descended into this internecine warfare between reactionary Shiite and Sunni factions.
Yeah.
We've always thought that Kurdistan, you know, maybe the Kurdish nationalist parties, which were in power there, you know, they're kind of authoritarian and patriarchal, but they're also kind of modernist and secularist. So why is this happening in Kurdistan now?
It's just what you know, a lot of people believe that whoever sees, like, they go visit for, like, just a small visit to Iraq, that will show how untrue. Besides, why do we compare Kurdistan's women's life to the worst point, you know, I mean, the rest of, why don't we compare it to the rest of the world where women's rights are like they have reached a lot of, like, they into to the highest point. So our goal is not to you know, compare ourselves and our situation in Iraq to what is happening in South. And oh, okay, we are better and there is, but still, with all that is all not true, because what happened in, if you visit, let's say, just visit any north of Iraq's hospital, you will see thousands of women burn themselves, and that is the easiest way for them to commit a suicide. Why is that? And it became a huge issue, like, I'm not sure if you know about it or not, that it became, even in the parliament, it became to a scary point. What does this mean, that women are just, like, killing themselves for no reason? There is an abuse that, and a violation of women's rights to the highest point in there. Whatever they say. Besides, when, just another point, if you allow me to just pass it on.
Yeah, please.
When we were in Iraq, I was a university student. We were working for women's rights, and we got thousands of threats against us. And they told us that's the whole reason we left Iraq. I would never, ever leave Iraq if I wasn't about to be killed.
Right, this was when, Kaya?
That was 1992-93. And I was a student. When I finished my school, every time I come home, I will listen to my sister telling me about how many women got killed in that city. And I know them. I've seen them. I know they have kids. Women's honor killing just started to be stronger, like heavy practice, a very common practice, daily practice, just after those Kurdish those Kurdish government came to the power. And the whole thing, they are all trying to I don't know how to put it in the right word, but just trying to say to those Islamic or movements that, you know what, we are Muslim too. We know how to make women, and it's by the name of honor killing. Honor killing did not exist in Iraq ever until like the 90s. Even Saddam Hussein himself tried to kill women after a certain time. So, you know, after like in 90s, because he was like, okay, in Kurdistan it's been happening, and women's movement became a huge. We had an office, we had a small shelter, we were being, they were running after us, thousands of activists got threatening that our parents were scared, and I would come home and my brother would tell me, you and your husband, you have to stop that. We don't want any trouble. You will be killed. Like my friend just leaving my house, he got killed because of his movement. So where is the freedom? Why do we compare like Kurdistan to some reactionary movement, which is worse?
I'm just trying to understand why this is happening in Kurdistan now.
Because it's a reactionary government. It's a government that based on discrimination, they are anti-women, they are anti-women's movement, they are trying to make themselves, you know, we are also, like we do also follow Sharia law. So don't try to, they are trying to make themselves good in front of other Islamic, forces.
Right, are you talking about
political Islamic? Yeah.
You're talking about the Kurdish regional government.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The KDP and the PUK, right?
Yes. Yeah. Kurdistan, KDP and PUK. They killed thousands of women, and that movement of killing and honor killing only stopped after we, like a lot of activists, left Iraq, and we made a huge, announcement in all over the world to support us and to stand against that. We told them we uncovered all these crimes against women, so it became very well known that Kurdistan's government is killing people, women. So they started to say, oh, no, we are now in a power. We will very well known that we are like almost known as a stable, politically stable, and we need to make the whole society stable. So, but that doesn't mean they did anything good to women. And there is they are just very good in stealing, that is, and taking, like buildings, what do you call their mansions for their political figures, but they have nothing, they have done nothing for people in Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. They haven't done it, and I don't have to just explain it to you in details. Any organization, you can ask any soldier, American soldier, they can explain to you how awful is the situation for women in Iraq. And in Kurdistan as well. So maybe in South and in Shia parts even worse, but that doesn't mean we should be happy. what is going on in Kurdistan, because it is not, it's nothing to be happened. It's very reactionary, and we should stand against that.
Yes, absolutely. But when you say that the two political parties which jointly rule Iraqi Kurdistan, the KDP and the PUK, when you say that they've killed hundreds of women, or did you say thousands of women, do you actually mean that they sort of permitted it? They allowed, tribal elders to carry out honor killings and so on. They didn't actually carry them out themselves.
They had the first, when I remember, for example, just to give you an example, there was a woman, and she was our neighbor. She had six kids, and they came to the, like, one of these figures in that city. They came to her husband, and they said, "You have to kill your wife, because we've heard this and this about her." The guy said, I don't want to kill my wife. I have six kids. And just leave me alone. So they said, because if we kill her, we could kill her anywhere and nobody know, but that will be a shame, because you are the one you need to kill her, because that will be an honor killing. Everybody will believe. So that is where the honor killing. They will force the family, and the guy did not kill her, but they tried to go to another family member. Of, like, let's say her brother or her cousin, and that is very common. That's what is happening. So it was even if it's because there it just came all of a sudden. There was nobody would kill his like daughter or his wife or no, like, just because of that. But there was a group of people, they will come, and we know that it is a political activity just to make the whole area unstable and to do anything just to make themselves important. They did not say, okay, we are, for example, there was no court, no, nothing like that to say, okay, you did this crime and that's why we are going to kill you. It was all done indirectly. But they are the ones forced people.
All right. Well, two questions. First, what happened? Was what happened to your friend? Did she live?
No, that is, I am talking about a friend of mine. He was an activist. He was talking as an activist for women's rights and children's rights. He was talking about against that. Reactionary movement.
Right, but the woman in the story that you just related.
Oh, they killed her. Yeah,
they did.
That one. I thought you were talking about my friend who the activist who got killed. Yeah, that lady they killed her because her husband didn't kill her, but they went to her cousin, and her cousin had someone with him.
Ugh.
They killed her with six. One of them was a baby. So they, and that was not just one. There was, I can tell, we had a book. In published in Kurdish and in Arabic, there's hundreds of women, and there was a list of thousands of them. They were working, like, you know, within 2-3 years, and they were working very actively, and they did kill a lot, but that stopped after the movement of women and like secularist women and. Our organization at that time, we had, you know, small organization. We had a small shelter that had been attacked a few times. Our activists, they were running. Like, for example, we wouldn't be able to stay in the house. Like, I have to make sure whoever knock at the door, I have to jump from the gate to my neighbor and then sneak out somehow. It was like this is the, or sometimes we didn't spend the whole week at home. We have to spend like away, to the point that one of our activists got killed just leaving my house because he was he didn't listen. They threatened him a few times. They said, "You either stop your activities or you're going to be killed." And he just disappeared a few days. And after we looked at him, like, we were looking for him for a few days, and we found his body in somewhere. Like, and the next person, for example, they said, okay, whoever is active, they threatened him a few times. Either he would leave the country or he had to stop the activity.
Or so this was when? How long?
That was 2003, 2004, 2005,
and so on. When your friend was killed, when the activist was killed?
It was 2003.
Mm-hmm. Or in Sulaymaniyah?
We had a huge demonstration against that in Sulaymaniyah, but the guy was killed in Duhok.
In Duhok. Mm-hmm.
Duhok is south of Turkey.
Right.
Yeah, close to Zaho.
Close
to Zaho.
Uh-huh.
You know, like
this was in Turkish territory or Iraq?
No. It's all in north of Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Not Kurdish, not Turkish.
Right, so near the Turkish border, you mean?
Very near, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the activity, most of our activity was in Sulaymaniyah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so another important question. When you say that, you know, these men came around to this woman's home and told the husband that he had to kill his wife, who were these guys? Who were these men?
They were the one that I just talked about. They are all from the Party Demokrati of Kurdistan. And
the KDP.
The KDP, but the same thing, it happens because we had a book, like I told you, we took about their stories. I was, for example, in that city, I would talk about the women that got killed, and I would make a report to our organization, for example, in Erbil. And my other friend will make it a report in women who got killed in Sulaymaniyah. So we have a book, and it's very well known, that was about over 10 years ago. We still have that book. It's in Kurdish and Arabic. It has the name and the date and the way they got killed. But somehow they will approach the family, and they will, even to the point of threatening them, you have to kill her or we are going to kill her. And if we kill her, it's a shame because this is a fair, that's an honor for you. You have to do it yourself. Everyone will appreciate you're trying to tell she's not good. And they, it's not just, for example, someone could be, she had an affair with someone, like she had a boyfriend, or maybe she's an activist. They will try to find any kind of reasons to kill her by the name of honor killing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so these guys were just like local political bosses of the KDP.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
they were like that. Mm-hmm. And actually, I did talk to one of them one time. One of them was close to, like, it's not a relative, but my family know him, and I was just finishing my university, and I came home, and I was, like, seeing him. I know he's awful. He tried to approach my brother to say, you have to stop her from going to university, and that's a shame for us and all that. And one day he said, I killed all these women. I said, why do you do that? He said, because I know they are not good. I said, okay, let's say, why they are not good? Because they had, like, for example, she had a boyfriend, she had a, she has an affair, or this one has, she doesn't believe in our tradition, or whatever reason they find, they will make it a good reason for them. And he was a really killer. Like, I even had a fight with him one time, but my brother would have just kicked him out of the house. So, yeah. But it was, like, too scary sometimes, you know. Maybe some people are very, very nice. They will say, okay, you know, don't interfere in our life and go away. But, you know, my activities, for example, if I did not leave in 2005, me or my husband, we would be killed. Mm-hmm. And a few times there was a big threatening against us. So that is why if you have any information about United Nations cases, like, you would be so surprised about what's going on in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say that this backlash against women began in Kurdistan even before the U.S. invasion. So you say it actually began in the late 1990s.
When Kurdish people came to power in the north of Iraq, they came with that agenda. Like the first thing in their agenda, besides their fighting with each other at that time, I don't know if you remember or not.
Yes.
Because there was a fight between
KDP,
you know,
and the PUK.
There was thousands of people got killed in a stupid conflict and nobody even until now know why. And I'm sure if it could happen any time again because their benefits, their political activities are always against each other. They are just for themselves. They are nothing for. Their goal is not to make the society stable.
They've worked out some kind of modus operandi between the two of them, and they formed a coalition.
Yeah, but when they came with an agenda that it's based on the first thing. It was their list of thousands of women. They had that list. I don't know when made, but they started with that. It started in 2000. I don't exactly know the date, but I remember 2002, 2003 until like now. And it stopped in a certain, in a way or another becoming too, because at that time it was like almost very common. Now it became a little less, and they started to say, okay, there is an activity, and the whole world knows that now they're working. Because we did have, even in TV, in Canada, and in Europe, in Turkey, we had demonstrations in a lot of government offices. It was a big issue at that time. It was a huge activity for us, we did. And it stopped somehow to be that common, but that doesn't mean it's completely stopped. It's still going on. For example, Doha, I don't know if it was all over the internet, the whole world knew about that girl got killed by stoning her in the street. Everybody knew about it. It was just a few months ago.
In Mosul?
Yes, that's the one.
Right, Doha Khalil Aswad. 17-year-old woman.
Yeah, the 17 years old. And to be honest, I called my brother back home and I talked to him about that. Do you know what's going on? He said he talked to me about two other women got raped by a few guys, and then because that's when a woman gets raped in there, there is no law protecting her. And they started the family will start. Okay, their final decision will be okay. We have no choice. She got raped. Here you go. She has to be killed now. That is the way that government deals with women. So where is women's rights in Iraq?
Okay. Well, the story that I heard was that she was a member of the Yazidi ethnic group, mm-hmm. and that she had a. Uh-huh. She had an Arab boyfriend, and she eloped to marry him, and she was then killed by she was stoned to death by her own Yazidi family for betraying her faith.
That is whatever the story is from what religious it was religious. Let's say if that happened in USA or in Canada or in Europe, someone gets killed by this way. Do you have to find any reason to kill her? That's our goal. It's she loves somebody from any religious or any that does not, you know, that's not an excuse to kill a woman for.
Right. I'm just trying to establish the facts as I understood them.
Yeah, but I to be honest, for us for women's activists, we don't need reasons for killing. That's our. I know that for example any Muslim, like if she has a boyfriend, she will get threatened somehow or another. But that should not be happening. That's our goal. Women's rights are like should be okay. She should be free to marry whoever she wants from whatever religious. Maybe she turns, she changed her religion, so she doesn't want to change. She want to keep. So that's what I'm saying. We should not find any excuses for them to say, oh, okay, because their tradition. Our tradition back home, based on abused women, does this mean we should accept it? I don't think so. And that is not accepted even anywhere. We believe that women's rights are universal, and we should fight for women's rights. And abuse is abuse. It doesn't matter by, like, a father or a mother or any family member or any religious or any reason.
Well, it's 1 o'clock in the morning here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And we are speaking by telephone from Toronto, Canada, with Kayal Ibrahim of the group Women's Liberation of Iraq, about particularly the situation in Kurdistan in the north of Iraq and the measure which is pending in the new constitution for Iraqi Kurdistan, which would allow polygamy. And the whole spate of honor killings, which have been carried out in Iraqi Kurdistan in recent months and recent years, which is a bit of a surprise even for those of us who follow the situation closely. There's sort of this impression that that the situation has been much better in Kurdistan than in South and Central Iraq. But maybe that only shows just how bad it's gotten in South and Central Iraq, because these horrific abuses also seem to be happening in Kurdistan as well, if perhaps it isn't quite as bad as it is in Baghdad or Basra. Well, that particular case that we were discussing, Duwa Khalil Aswad, 17-year-old young woman who was stoned to death by her own family because she was of the Yazidi faith and she eloped with an Arab. That sort of was a converging of the sexual violence and the ethnic violence, because in retaliation for her death, there was a massacre of local Yazidis by some Arab youth, apparently. Textile workers in Mosul, 23 of them were killed in a revenge killing for the killing of this young woman when their vehicle was stopped by a bunch of gunmen and they were just put up against a wall and shot execution style. You were following this, right?
Yes, that's true. I am following. I believe that's one of the reason I'm telling you that. Women, like people in Iraq, are open-minded to the point, but they, and whatever I see now, it wasn't there. Like when we go to a visit, we see changes toward reactionary, backward, you know, instead of trying to follow the world, what's women's life doing. In all aspects, you see that is going backward every day. So that's what I'm saying. Those people, because there's a lot of people don't agree with that. So there is a fight. Like I told you, polygamy, when I was a child, I remember whoever get like married to, it was there. You will see maybe one person has two wives in thousands, but if you know, it's now it's trying to make a law that, and that person, by the way, he was always like, you know, everybody hated him. Oh my God. And for example, nobody would marry his son because they are afraid, you know, he's gonna do. What does this mean? That means that nobody wants that action. That is a backward thing to do, so that they were against that. And people in Iraq, they love to read, they love to follow the world, they love freedom, but they need chance, they need to work on that. So that's why we need to work when all freedom lovers, all humanitarians, all secular groups, and even individuals, we believe that, like, who believe in gender equality and, you know, to work with us and to support us in this issue. And we believe that every voice counts, and it makes a big difference in women's life in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So, why is this? Why? What's your analysis as to why this is happening? Why is this happening now? Why has there been this this backlash over the last 10-15 years against women?
Because it's based on Islamic Sharia law, and I believe any religious any like if the civil law was like based on secular society, the separation of state from let's say people's life from religion, it would not happen. That wouldn't be that would be an individual choice. If you want to be a religious, go ahead, be a religious, do whatever. But becoming because that's a law from Sharia law. It was there 1,400 years ago. And they are bringing and they are trying to make it a law for 2009. That's why, how can you bring us to, and that law, it's based on discrimination against women. Women has no right to travel by herself. She has half of the man's right even in witnessing in court. For example, if I'm in Iraq, I want to witness, I will be having half of my maybe 5 years old brother, because he's a man and he is considered as a person, but women are considered as object or they don't even consider them as a person. They are there for men's pleasure, for just to take care of their kids. And to encourage all kind of, to just to be there for the man, and what is he to be a slave for a woman, for a man, and having a wife, and if she is not he's not too happy, he can have another one, and that if that become a law in Iraq. Of course, there is going to be an abused woman. There is going to be tons of beating women who wants to share, like let's say have two women who wants to her husband to get married again. That is because we believe that this is embracing of the reactionary law by ruling the nationalist Islamic forces. And this is dominating the parliament. It's completely a violation of women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you say, for instance, that in your youth, polygamy was very uncommon. What about now? Is it now that it's about to be, it seems, embraced by the regional constitution of Kurdistan? Is it much more common?
I believe anything, if you make it as a law, it will be a cultural issue. Maybe there is some people would never ever believe in that because they are very open-minded. They don't follow with that. That's true, but there is some people reactionary and, they may. So why that law should give them that chance if there's wrong things happening, that doesn't mean we should make it as a law. Okay, let's say in Canada, if that happened, someone is stealing, but if that it became a law, it's okay for you to steal in a certain point or with a certain condition. Of course, there is going to be more stealing. That's what I'm saying. So if there is a law that allows them, it will happen. It will become more tradition. It will be abuse women more, and we don't have these shelters for women that in that area. We don't have a law to protect women. Whatever is there is only for men. How can a woman? She will have no choice but to go and burn herself when she has no other choices. When they kill themselves by burning, it's like just for them you know, it's a relief for them.
Kill themselves by burning.
That is very common back home.
Oh.
Because that is the easy way out. They don't have a gun to kill themselves. And that is, if you visit, you know, Iraqi hospitals, you will see thousands of women gotten burned. And it became, like I said, it became a huge issue recently. The last year was about even the parliament were like freaked out because there was you know that the whole world is now aware of that issue with women kill you know suiciding by killing themselves. It was the easiest way.
But by self-immolation, by burning.
Yeah, that is it's you believe it or not, that is the only way they have. I'm not trying to encourage that, but I'm just trying to give you a fact.
This has been widespread in Kurdistan, in the north as well?
In all over the Iraq, but in Kurdistan it was very, very common recently because of the violation of women's rights. They have no other choice. They don't even have a gun to make their killing easier or their suicidal easier. They have the oil at home, what do you call the gas, and the one that they cook for it, and they cannot take the abuse anymore, the humiliation, the beatings by the husband, as if there is two wives in the house, and he is, he comes home and yell at them and scream at them and beat them out, and they end up fighting with each other. What does this this life end up like meaningless to them? So they do that. They do kill themselves. They don't have any other solution, because if they go back to their families would not, you know, welcome them. Nobody will tell her husband why you're doing that to your wife, because the whole law is, that's what I'm saying, that things become cultural when you are when the law is there. If there, like someone, if there is a law that says no polygamy, you know, he will have less power somehow. He will not be able to, even if he gets he should be, you know, like he someone will have to tell him, no, you break the law. That's that is not exist now. That doesn't exist now. That's why the woman has no other choice, no alternative. She cannot go to work. She cannot support herself. She has no right. She has no right to divorce. So that, all these things, so she has no other solution except...
All right, so what does the new constitution say about divorce?
That, it gives, it says she is allowed to divorce, but that is just, if you come to reality... If there is tons of forces, that's why women in Iraq getting divorced, it means what? She has no food. She will lose the custody of the child completely. Even if her husband die and somehow, the family of her husband would take the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that means nothing. So if she wants to divorce, her family doesn't welcome her, and there's no one would support her financially. Where does she go? She has even the jobs in Iraq, you know, the situation and economically back home and financially. How can she support herself? You know, she doesn't agree, she will be divorced. But you cannot imagine the pressure on her, in the family members and in the community forces. So she would never divorce. I am telling you, I know women got, you know, their husband got married again, and when I asked them, why did you do that? She said, what do? I have no one. I when I'm married, nobody else would marry me because I'm married. I had two kids. Nobody would ever believe that I'm worth a penny. And when she goes to her family, her family is, they have their own life and they will not welcome me, and they cannot even support me financially. And try, besides all that, there is a cultural thing. It's a shame on the family for their wife, for their, you know, for their women to be divorced. A divorced woman in Islam is the worst solution. It's never welcomed the solution for that society. So that's why she will be, everyone will look at her as a piece of, you know, junk, and nobody respect her either. Nobody would even marry her again. So that's why she has no choice. She would say, you know what, beating me a few times, it's better than getting divorced.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I still don't have a real clear sense of what is driving this whole process, especially since you say that this backlash against women and this accommodation with or embrace of reactionary Islamism and fundamentalism, Sharia law, began when Saddam was still in power and before the invasion of Iraq. What's been driving the whole process? I mean, certainly the KDP and the PUK had secular roots. They didn't begin as Islamist parties. Authoritarian, patriarchal, certainly, but not particularly fundamentalist.
No, I believe this and the whole process is not just new. The whole thing is it's based on Islamic Sharia law. And it came somehow, it gets better in a certain, let's say maybe in 70s it was a lot better. And, but that doesn't mean it was always, it doesn't mean it did not exist.
Okay, so why has it deteriorated since the 1970s?
Because that's what I'm saying. There is a power, there is an unstable thing, there is a Sharia law, there is Islamic forces, the Islam, political Islam, they are trying to, how we can say that they are everywhere. There is Qaeda cells in every city. There is, for example, in 90s and 80s, we used to go to school I've never wear the hijab. I've always wear like normal, girl in anywhere, like a skirt and even short sleeves. But when in 90s, whoever the girl, if she wears the skirt, there was some kind of acid they would throw in her leg and she would get burned or in her face.
And this was happening in Sulaymaniyah in Kurdistan?
Yes, that is happening in all over.
So I've heard about this sort of thing in Basra.
In all Iraq. And when we went back home for a visit, I see everybody's almost wearing a hijab, a long skirt. That, what is going on? They said we are not, they're afraid of their life. They don't want to, that is all from the Islamic forces, the Islamic beliefs that became so strong in these past years. And it's all based on Sharia Islam, that they want to make unstable society for the, that's the whole thing. So for the Kurdish people to protect themselves, to say, you know what, we are all from Muslim, we are also believe in Sharia law, that's why we are going to do that. So it's all based on Islamic roots, we can say. That's my belief. Otherwise, it did exist in 1970s. You go to Baghdad, you would see women in bikini and women in bars, women in going in, and they are going to movie theaters. There's activities like any other part of the world. But now, can you see a woman in Baghdad? Like, how do you see the streets in Baghdad? And all these are, university educated women in there. But they cannot, even, for example, not just Muslim people, not just Shia and Sunni and all these things. There's, for example, a lot of other religious, and there's Christian, there's Catholic, there's, they end up wearing this. They don't have their belief, they don't have that, but they have no choice.
To take the hijab.
She doesn't want to end up coming home, her skin is burned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so basically what you're saying is that beginning in the 1980s, political Islamist organizations, sort of on the Al-Qaeda model or whatever, began...
Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so beginning in the 1980s and much more strongly in the 90s, organizations of political Islam began organizing at the grassroots, began organizing cells in throughout Iraq and so on. And in Kurdistan, the KDP and the PUK, rather than fighting them and defending secularism, they capitulated and tried to co-opt this element. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes, it's so true. For example, in 1992 or 93, there was a group of Islamic, I don't know, the organization or the movements, or they have, I'm sure they have, they could be from even Qaeda. They came, what they did, there is a lot of people, they lost, for example, they have a very bad financial situation. There was a group of them. They have opened a small, let's say, houses to teaching people some Quran and some of religious things, and they have some rules for them. For example, a 5 years old, she has to be completely covered, and when they
at five years old,
they would go there and they will teach them some Quran and some of their reactionaries, and they will show that, and the girls and boys, they have to wear certain Islamic, like, just like the way they wear it in Afghanistan. And that wasn't a common thing in Iraq. That was completely weird things and rejected, but because the mother, for example, lost her husband in war, and she's not aware of that. Her two, even a boy, the boy maybe could be trained somehow to be a terrorist, but she has to send that child there so that when he comes, maybe they will give him some food. That was also happened, and they trained people to read the Quran and all these reactionary beliefs that all based on women's discrimination, and that women are inferiority. Women has no, she should just listen to her husband, and she should, for example, God said that you have no power, man has power over women. The women has half of their inheritance, all kind of things. Then father has to decide who is she's gonna marry, and she's not supposed to see even her husband that's gonna, let's say, spend the rest of her life starting tomorrow. She did not see. So all these kind of things that based on discrimination again, on rules, is based on Islamic Sharia law.
Okay, so your group, Women's Liberation of Iraq, is attempting to raise the alarm about this, attempting to build some international opposition. How can people find out more? How can they get involved?
We have our campaign, and we already had a petition online in three languages.
Yeah. is a coordinated monthly test of the broadcast stations of your area. Equipment that can quickly warn you of emergencies is being tested. If this had been an actual emergency, official messages would have followed the alert tone. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
And this concludes 1010 Wind's test of the emergency alert system. When she is time 124, President Obama appearing on NBC TV last night admitting that he screwed up, blaming himself for the tax flap involving Tom Daschle, whom he nominated for health secretary.
Ultimately, there's no excuse for him. And, I think that Tom, as well as myself, understood that. I think he made the assessment that it was going to be too much of a distraction.
And
support, and we also, we call all egalitarian, all secular, all group individuals, and we believe in gender equality between men and women. And they can call us in our. I'm sorry, that thing is kicked.
Yes.
I have my email address. They can call, like, send me an email. It's the khayalibrahim at yahoo.ca. And they can send me any email. I can send them information in different languages. They can call me in Arabic. I can talk to them in Arabic or Kurdish. Or English, I don't mind, and we can get the support from any type of support. It will make a huge difference for women in Iraq, because we do believe that women's rights are universal, and we have to work together. It doesn't mean that I left Iraq, that's it. Let's just, I'm free. I will not be free until I feel that all women in Iraq are free.
Okay, is there a website or somewhere online where people can sign your petition?
Yeah, there is a website. It's Ahewar.
I'm sorry?
Let me give you the website. But it's in Arabic. That's why if they can email me, I can send them.
All right.
I can send them. If they email me, I can send them in different because there is more than one language, they can just check. There is a petition in Arabic, Hiwar al Mutamaddin, but I have to spell that for you. That is in Arabic.
All right, well, that sounds like it might be a little bit complicated. I'll tell you what.
Yes.
I'll just...
It's in Arabic and other languages, if I tell you. Even my spelling may end up not properly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I've already put your petition on my own website, World War IV Report. And we'll link to that on the website for this radio show as well. So certainly listeners can find out more by looking there. And what about the ALFI website, the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq? I assume this information is there as well.
We do hear from, but we are not working very closely. But they are also, we believe they are also working for women's rights. And we don't, we are a different organization.
Right. Well, they're less active in Kurdistan, I suppose.
Sorry?
They're less active in Kurdistan, and you're more.
They are more active in
Baghdad
and
yeah.
South and all that. But they can. There is a website they call. It's a Modern Discussion, and there is Modern Discussion. If you type moderndiscussion.org.
Modern Discussion.
Modern Discussion. That's a website a lot of, activists and our two languages are there. And the rest, you can email me in my email.
Okay.
I can send it.
All right. And that's Khayal Ibrahim at Yahoo,
.ca, yeah.
Right. Yahoo.ca for Canada. Khayal Ibrahim, that's KHAYALIBRAHIM, Khayal Ibrahim at Yahoo.ca.
Yes.
If anybody wants more information, they can contact you directly. Or just watch the website for this radio show, More Orthodox Radio Crusade, morc.info, and we'll have all the information there as well. So we're out of time. Kyle, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us tonight. This has been extremely informative, and I urge you to stay in touch with us and keep us updated on this situation. And when the new constitution is finally approved in Iraqi Kurdistan, we'll definitely give an update on what's happening with that situation.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you. And you can't imagine how important to live in let the people know how, you know, that affects the women's rights in Iraq.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Well, we'll be in touch, Kyle.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. And with that, this has been, I'm sorry about the interference there with some emergency broadcast gobbledygook from El Gobierno, but what can you do? Do stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up next on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. And join us next week when we'll be asking...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.